Hi, today's April 8th, 2018. This is MobiView's podcast number 249, Taru Gasaort, my good friend John Westfall. We have a kind of a bunch of random stuff. Nothing super important, but a lot of interesting things.
But it's par for our course.
That's right. Yeah, we should name it the Random Views podcast.
It gets more and more like that every week.
Okay, first thing is something I noticed yesterday, which apparently started a couple of weeks ago, and so I popped into Starbucks. I am not what you would call a regular customer. I don't go there like every day, maybe once a week, maybe not even that. But anyway, I did go yesterday, which is Saturday, April 7th. And, you know, while I was waiting for my drink, because I didn't mobile order, I kind of like to wander in and decide once I get there. Ordered my drink, which is a matcha green tea frappuccino, and popped onto the Wi-Fi while I waited. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to see that, you know, usually it says, do you accept the terms, and boom, you're in, right? Well, when I went yesterday, it asked me for a first name, a last name, an email address, and a zip code. So I said, okay. After I got home, I did a little bit of research and found that Seattle PI, which is, I forget what the P is for, but I remember the I is Intelligencer, mm-hmm. The old newspaper, which is now online only. Anyway, they have a March 22 article, dated March 22nd, that talks about this, you know, Starbucks grabbing your email. And really, I should say it's Google grabbing your email, because Starbucks Wi-Fi, at least where I am, is provided by Google Wi-Fi. I don't know, John, your thoughts? I was kind of curious why they decided to do that.
It doesn't really strike me as too strange to ask, you know, who you are and why you're using the free Wi-Fi. And in some cases, I could see this being something that would be a positive to customers. You know, if some point if Starbucks wanted to, you know, reward you for using their Wi-Fi or something like that. But what it's most likely for is for marketing, in which case I put down in our show notes something that I think people often forget. If you have a Gmail account, you can create sort of on-the-fly aliases by using your regular email address and then the plus sign and then at whatever domain. So if you have bob@whatever.com, you could put Bob plus Starbucks at whatever.com, and that will still go to your regular Gmail, but now if that company, in this case Starbucks, starts selling your information, you just want a quick and easy way to shut it down, you can just create the trash, all the Bob plus Starbucks at whatever.com.
That's a good tip. I didn't know that.
It's a nice way to sort of do that. I've done that with a lot of companies over the years, just if I don't quite know what they're planning on doing.
Right.
Or it's also good if you need to sign up for a new service or sign up for a second account for a service and you need a unique email address. You can sort of create as many as you need with that. So, for example, I've had services where I've needed a testing account to make sure that if I'm offering a job or something on Upwork, it looks okay from another perspective. And so I've used it for that. So there are a lot of good benefits to that. But if you are hesitant about giving out your actual email address, you could always create a you know, throwaway Gmail and then start using this with that throwaway Gmail to see who's using and who's selling your information.
Okay, let me step aside for a second, though, and dip into our Mythical Conspiracy Views podcast. But since this is a Google Wi-Fi and we're using a Google service, Google could theoretically just say, we'll ignore your filters if it's from Starbucks.
Well, that is true. That is definitely true. So you have to sort of pick your battles as you were with this.
Yeah.
But it at least is one way, and I've done it in a number of situations where it's
worked. Yeah, that's a good idea. It's a really good idea. What I did is I actually created an account, a separate account, not a Gmail account, but a separate account in one of my services just for doing things like registering products. So you know, there's no filtering. Everything just goes there. It's a real email address. It's a unique email address. But anyway, next up was something that surprised me and not surprised me. So the title of the article by Jeff Geerling on his blog is Raspberry Pi Micro SD Card Performance Comparison 2018. So he's done this before. And, you know, he's got a new Raspberry Pi 3, I guess, so he wanted to test it. And, you know, we know, you and I know, John, that not all SD cards are created equal. You know, some cards are designed to be faster, you know, especially for back in the days when digital camera speed was important. You stick it in your digital camera, and if you want to take a lot of shots, a fast SD card makes a difference if you're doing burst mode or something. But this is the statement that really caught me off guard. So remember, he's done this benchmark before, and he wrote, I decided to rerun all the benchmarks from all Samsung and SanDisk cards. The rest, from Sony, Toshiba, Alexar, and no-name brands, were so slow for Pi usage as to not warrant any testing at all. Yeah. And we're not talking about, he does say no-name brands at the end, but Sony, Toshiba, and Alexar are not no-name brands. I mean, I've probably used all of them at one point or another. Now, I haven't done benchmarks, and I haven't done anything that's speed critical, but I found that surprising. So
it's always interesting to see what the comparisons are on these things, but to sort of group all of them in one place and not even test them seems kind of crazy that there would be so little difference. But
yeah.
You know, years ago when solid-state media came out, we were all trying to figure out were they better or worse, and it seems like it's all just reliability. Sometimes it's more similar than we would think different between brands.
Well, that's what he said. So he did all his work on the new Raspberry Pi Model 3 B+, which I think is now a quad-core or something. Not a quad-core, but a quad-processor. I guess it's quad-core. And he has some benchmarks using a couple of different tests. And he does, have prices, the Amazon price. And he also knows, and I didn't know this, you can overclock the Raspberry Pi's micro SD card reader. Did you know that? That's news to me.
Yeah, I did not know that, but that's another interesting one.
Yeah, so he says, you can also overclock the micro SD card reader in the Raspberry Pi to eke out a tiny bit more performance from the cards. I don't think I saw an article what he's using that's so speed dependent. But anyway, very interesting stuff. If you're a Raspberry Pi user and you're looking for a card to buy, he recommends the top three, all available from Amazon: the Samsung Evo Plus, which is $15; SanDisk Extreme, $19; and Samsung Pro Plus, which is $27. And none of them are super expensive. And, it's something you're going to use every day with your Raspberry Pi, since that is the, unlike other computers, your SD card is your
drive. It's all you have.
It's all you got, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not going to get a real solid-state drive or something. That is your solid-state drive. So, anyway, speed is important, and $15 for Samsung Evo Plus sounds pretty good to me.
Mm-hmm.
Or even 19 for the even 27, quite frankly, for the Samsung Pro Plus. They're all affordable. Anyway, there you go. Raspberry Pi microcard performance test by Jeff Geerling. Very interesting stuff. He's got a lot of graphs and things, so you can decide for yourself what's important to you. Okay. Next up is another interesting thing that I read over the week. I haven't tried this yet. So, Cloudflare, for most people, are probably known for their services as kind of DDoS attack service. If you're getting DDoS, they'll help you deal with that hit on your network.
Yeah.
They've got a new DNS service. Now, they've got a couple. There are other DNS services. There's Dyn DNS is probably the best known. Google has a free DNS service. They're all free. Yeah.
Open DNS, which Open lets DNS. You yeah. Modify and track DNS queries off your network.
Yeah. And Cloudflare now has one. It's 1.1.1.1. Is that too many ones? 1.1.1.1. Yeah, that's right, 4. There's also 1.0.0.1, which I think you can use as a secondary. I haven't tried it yet, but they're using it to not just provide a free service, but actually as for study purposes. So when you sign up for the free service, you're also providing data to Cloudflare to analyze, basically. To see what kind of stuff is coming in. And they're saying their new DNS is attracting gigabits per second of rubbish. So, and I guess, as we know, most of the internet is now rubbish. So that's not too surprising. And on a related note, they have a Twitter account called 11114 Resolver, capital R. So 1111 Resolver, twitter.com/that. That is called their Cloudflare 1.1.1.1 Twitter resolver. And so you can throw an IP address at it and it'll resolve it to the name associated with it. Anywho, so that's that. I haven't tried it yet. I plan to. I was going to try it in a Windows box. A test Windows box I had. Windows, running Windows 10. But you know, Windows 10 is really hard to change the DNS. I mean, I went into the right setting, I changed it, and it changed right back to my default. Not sure what was going on.
Yeah, there. I use OpenDNS.com, and I actually just set it on my router level. So the router forwards all DNS queries instead of to my ISP, which does annoying things with DNS queries and, you know, redirects things to ads and things like that. I just set it to OpenDNS, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, that's a smart thing to do, because if you set your notebook, for example, there was pros and cons. So the pro is this. If you set your notebook to an alternative DNS, instead of letting it resolve to wherever you are, when you go to, well, your workplace probably won't let you, you know, get on their network anyway with a personal device. But if you go to somewhere else that requires you use their DNS, then it won't work anymore, oftentimes, at least for the internal intranet site. On the other hand, everything in your behind the router now automatically knows how to use the new DNS. It doesn't have to tell it about it. So, but if you go to somewhere like Starbucks, now you're going to your notebook, which is not behind the Cloudflare or OpenDNS or whatever. Now you're using the default DNS. So it depends how you use your machine. If you're going to be out in a public hotspot, you probably want to set it on your device, unless you need to use an intranet, in which case you can't. Anyway, there we go. 1.1.1.1. That's hard.
1.1. I think it's easy to look at, hard to say.
Yeah, like Google's 8.8.8.8, I think. And I don't know what OpenDNS is.
Yeah, it's similar. I think it's all 2.22s or something like that.
Yeah. Quick item, and this one is from Google. It's called the Google Arts and Culture Monet and Architecture Virtual Exhibit. Well, that's what I'm calling it, actually. Architecture Virtual Exhibit. If you go to artsandculture.google.com/project/Monet was here. You'll see kind of a travelogue based on Monet's paintings. And if you're a fan of Impressionists and Monet in particular, I think you'll find this kind of interesting. Google does some interesting stuff with their bazillions of dollars. So it's good to have bazillions of dollars and stuff nobody else would pay for, but a lot of us find interesting. Okay, next item I find very interesting, but I'm not sure I can afford. And Microsoft announced that Skype for Content Creators will be available later this summer. And what it does is it works with third-party applications that supports their API. And I'll just read it. It says, this is what they say. With Skype for Content Creators, Windows 10 and Mac users will be able to select the Content Creators mode to place and record calls directly within NewTek, N-E-W-T-E-K. NDI-enabled software such as Wirecast, XSplit, and vMix. So what it means is, here we go. Once the call is recorded, it basically lets you record a call with these third-party apps. Once the call is recorded, content can be easily imported into apps such as Adobe Premiere Pro and Adobe Audition for editing. In addition, users can customize the look and feel of the call so they can be part of a live show ready for streaming to audiences of all sizes. Okay, so is this something I'm going to use? I don't know. Because when I looked it up before we started the podcast, Wirecast is $1,000. XSplit is $200 currently. That's its sales price. And vMix is $700 for two callers. I think two callers is literally two people calling you in, which is, you know, acceptable for me most of the time. And $1,200 for eight callers. And you have had more than three people on the podcast. So I'd have to go to, you know, basically the only one that makes sense price-wise for me is XSplit. If I go with the current $200 sales price, I have to make up my mind fairly quickly, I guess, if I'm going to buy into that. Buy into something I can't use for a couple of months, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. If ever, because we know this is Microsoft we're talking about here.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? And it may be that, you know, not everybody will be able to download this Skype for Content Creators. You know, maybe you need to have a special agreement in Microsoft to be one of those people. I think that a version of Skype that not Skype for Business, which, of course, you know, you need to be a business, have a business license for, and can record, by the way. That can already record Skype calls automatically. Anyway, we don't know who's going to be able to download this. There's, you know, I didn't read every single word of the blog item. But when I scanned it, I didn't see any restrictions, but I didn't see any, you know, thing that said it'll be available for everybody. Just says available. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's easier just to use regular Skype and use something like what you use with Audio Hijack Pro or I've got, you know, Soundflower is something that's been around forever on macOS that lets you redirect audio streams and mix them together. And that tends to make it a lot easier to do these sorts of things.
Yeah. And Audio Hijack, it's not that expensive. I think I paid $30 or $40 originally, and then I upgraded recently for like $20 or $30. So, and, you know, I've been using this for nearly 10 years now. So, you know, it's been, I don't know, let's say I paid $60 total, you know, paid $6 a year. That's pretty reasonable if you amortize it. Yeah, so I don't think I'm going to go with this. And although it would be nice to be able to use something on Windows, I just realized yesterday when I booted up my primary Windows notebook for the first time in probably over a month to update it, that, you know, I hardly ever use it for anything anymore. Except for, you know, its primary purpose is now to run Windows Update.
Hopefully it's doing that just fine.
Yeah. Actually, I had a problem booting up yesterday, which is sort of, it kind of stuck on the firmware boot screen, didn't even get to Windows. And I had to kind of, you know, do a force power down and then try to reboot again. But the problem for me is, you know, it would be nice to be able to use a Windows box to record these calls. You know, right now Audio Hijack is only available for macOS. And that's fine. You know, it's been running for me for almost 10 years now. So I don't have any complaints about how it runs. But Macs are expensive, generally speaking. You know, you can pick up a pretty nice Windows notebook for $400 or $500 to record this podcast just fine. If I had software, they would do it reliably. I've tried a couple of things, and I didn't find any of them to be reliable, so I won't name names. But, it would be nice to have the option to use a cheaper device than a MacBook or MacBook Pro or MacBook Airs. You know, something half the price when I have to do a replacement. At any rate, not to insult the MacBook Air I'm using right now, which is 4.5 years old, almost 5, and it's still running just fine. Alrighty. Next up, I wanted your take on this, John.
Okay, so you found an article about something called Skynet.
Yeah, it's in the Atlantic, by the way. It's like mainstream. Yes.
The idea here is that a programmer with a little bit of interest in artificial intelligence, as well as someone who also knits, tried to teach an artificial intelligence how to create knitting patterns, which is a unique idea. Knitting patterns sort of look like a programming language of their own when you start to read them. I've just started knitting in the last 3-4 months, and so I'm still figuring out some of the shorthand and some of the things that you see in these patterns, but they do very much remind me of a programming language. The idea here is, though, you teach an AI about what often occurs in a knitting pattern, then you let it create knitting patterns. And the enthusiast community for knitting and crocheting, Ravelry.com, has several members who have started to knit these things that Skynet is pumping out. And they all just look absolutely dreadful at this point. There's nothing in there, I think, that is really all that interesting. It's interesting that no human wrote the pattern. I will give it that. But I don't think we're quite there yet. I think I'll stick with patterns created by people, because the stuff that Skynet is creating just doesn't seem all that interesting.
Well, it's a new designer, right? So
it's a new designer. It hasn't found its voice yet, right, or its style. And right now its style is pretty horrible. So I do think it's an interesting thing to look at, though.
All right. So what it needs is a neural net to take feedback, to say this was good, this was bad, this was kind of okay.
Well, and the interesting thing about the article, if you've never looked into knitting, if you kind of wondered, it does talk a little bit about knitting patterns. So it's kind of interesting if you've always wondered how people who knit are able to create something. There's an instruction manual, and the instructions are written in shorthand. So that was the other interesting thing from the article. Someone who has never knitted before would probably find that of interest.
Yeah, so, you know, my take on it was, and I didn't really understand what the output looked like. I mean, I looked at the output and go, is that good? Is that bad? I can't tell, really, to be honest. You know, something knitted, and who am I to judge if it's good or bad? You know, but I will say this. Two things I'll say is that, first, I love the name, because obviously it's a take from Skynet from Terminator. The other is, basically, It's so appropriately named because it's controlling a human 3D printer, the Knitter.
Yeah, that's true.
So, anywho, found it interesting. It was good to get some feedback from John. Now I know it's ugly, and I just couldn't figure it out. I just looked at it.
Well, it looks ugly to me. I mean, I'll ask other Knitter friends, and if any of them say it's great, I'll let you know.
Okay. All right, now I've got a rant, so bear with me.
You have a rant and I have a rave. So.
Okay. So my rant is this. It's good. A little bad and then good. And I think we discussed this last week, that Google is going to turn off GOO.GL, their hyperlink shortener. I think it gets turned off for new people on April 13th, which is coming up later this week. Today is April, whatever today is, 9th? 8th. Today's April 8th. So in a couple of days, if you have an existing account through your Gmail, then you can still use it for a little while, I think. And I downloaded all my data. Not sure what I would do with it, but I downloaded all my data before it gets shut off completely, I think, in a few months or next year or something. But you won't be able to use it. And Cloudflare, which is another Google product, Firebase Dynamic Links, which is another Google product, is something that Google points you to. But that's really only for developers. There is no consumer level service for it. We just pop in a URL and out pops a short link. So the problem is that I left, and then they recommend using Bitly or something else. I forget what this is. So I left Bitly years ago for Google's shortener because Bitly is so unreliable. I don't know if it's still true, but it was so unreliable back then that I give up. And I started using Google.gl. So now I'm back to Bitly. I don't know, John?
My solution. There is actually an open source piece of software called URLs, or URL. I guess you would call it URLS.
Okay.
YOURLS. It stands for your own URL shortener.
Yo URLs.
I don't know how you are actually supposed to pronounce it.
Yeah.
But you basically can get your own domain name, get yourself a cheap hosting package or wherever you would host your own website, and install this, and then you can create your own short URLs from your own domain, which then you can always control and transition over and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it does the same sort of tracking and stats and all those things that we're used to with other URL shorteners, and has a bunch of plugins that you can use and things like that. So that's my solution because, quite frankly, I hate giving people an address that I don't have complete control over. The idea here is even if someday you were to decide to shut down this domain, you could keep it on life support and just have it all forward to one thing or whatever you'd want. But that's my solution. I've been using this for about a year and a half now on two different domains that I own.
And, but you're depending on them to resolve the shortened URLs, right? I mean,
yeah, so it means that my virtual private server has to stay up and my hosting package has to stay up, which, it's a six of one, half dozen of another. You depend on someone else, they can shut it down. You depend on yourself, you decide when you shut it down what happens to it. So in this case, if I've got some of these domains that are pointing to things and I decide I don't want to do this, I could always set up just a regular htaccess redirect or something like that to keep the URL working even if I uninstalled the software. So
But at any rate, to continue on to my rant, because I'm just kind of in a ranting kind of mood, that's the problem with Google. You start to use a service/product from them that you really like, and we've had many that we really like, John, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And then they turn it off. Google bought a wiki. I forget which wiki service they bought, but it was really good. And I liked it, and they turned it off. And, Google Voice has kind of been deprecated. And it won't even work on Google Fi.
Did you see there was an article this week that Voice is going to get Wi-Fi calling, though?
Google Voice?
Yes. Let me see if I can find that.
I didn't see that.
I thought about this.
Okay. I'll tap dance while you go look for that. So,
Google is running an open beta for Wi-Fi calling. The article that I'll send you is off of androidcentral.com. Mm. And it did just come out, I guess it was earlier this week, April 5th. Google Voice receives a long overdue redesign January of 2017. Yep, we know that. But it doesn't have voice over IP. On Google Voice Help Forum, Google announced it's running an open beta for Wi-Fi / data calling that's integrated directly into Google Voice. And if you're interested in it, you can go fill out a form and potentially get in on this open beta. So I'm actually starting to use my Google Voice number again a little more than I used to, because now that it supports MMS messaging and group messaging, I've been actually using it quite a bit more. So I might start going back to using my Google Voice number.
Yeah. Let's see. Known issues. I'm looking at productforums.google.com on this topic. Obi-Hi devices. I don't even know what that is. Obi-Hi devices won't work if you enable calling over Wi-Fi. I don't know what it is. I don't care. You won't be able to use incoming calls option, call recording, call transfer, when you enable calling over Wi-Fi and mobile data. You won't be able to use incoming call options. Call recording.
That's
call.
Probably the, the answering machine preview options and all those that...
Okay, which I don't use.
...does so offer. I think because you're receiving it not over an actual cellular connection. Right, you're receiving it over Wi-Fi.
On your computer, Wi-Fi calling... Wow, this is non-grammatical or ungrammatical. On your computer, Wi-Fi calling only work with Chrome. Maybe it is. I can't tell. On your computer, Wi-Fi calling only work with Chrome. Support for Firefox... Wi-Fi calling only works with Chrome. Support for Firefox, Safari, and Edge coming soon! Exclamation point. So it only works with Chrome. Android Bluetooth support. You won't be able to use the buttons on your Bluetooth device to answer calls or hang up. Well, that's kind of annoying. Well, it doesn't matter for me because I can't use Google Voice on my phone.
The odd thing is that it will work over iOS because iOS forces everything to go through one common channel. Which is kind of an irony that on Google's own platform, it's too segmented. Yeah. iOS, your headset buttons will work just fine.
Yeah. Unable to use earpiece mode when Bluetooth device is paired. Depending on your Android version, your calls might drop if you switch between Bluetooth and speakerphone. Well, that doesn't sound like a big deal. On Android, can I use a phone app to make calls or Wi-Fi? I don't think this will work at all for me. Well, it won't work on my Google, Fi Android device, because I can't use, you can't use Google Voice on a Fi device or a device with a Fi number, which is kind of annoying. How much data to Wi-Fi? Calls use approximately 0.2 megabytes data per minute. No, that's not. Well, it could be a big deal. I don't know. Okay, anyway, I'll put both links to the Android Central article that John pointed out, and then I found the Google's own place where you can sign up for it. I need to read more. I because I'm a Google Fi user, it could screw up things royally. So I will hold off on that for a minute. Okay, I see you have one more thing in the show notes.
Yeah, so this was my rave this week. It's something that I'm going to give Microsoft props for and hope that they don't pull it away from me now that it's been discovered. Although it's been discovered for a while, apparently. So in my work life, I often have people who want to make appointments with me. Not that I get to charge them for these things, because they're people who are already paying for my time through tuition dollars. But, I have a little bit of a frustration because a typical email correspondence goes something like this. Hey, Dr. Westfall, do you have time to meet tomorrow? And I look at my calendar and I write back, oh, yeah, I've got time at 8:30, 9:30, and 11 o'clock.
Okay.
And the person then writes back, okay, I'll stop by then. And then I have to write back, okay, what time would you like to stop by? Because, A, I have two different offices, so I might be in two different places at 8:30, 9:30, and 11 o'clock that. And then they'll go, oh, well, I guess I'll come by at 11. Okay, then I can put on my schedule.
Right.
And in sometimes I get, this week was a busy week. I had someone on Tuesday email me, and they said, do you have time on Thursday? I said, oh, I've got 2:30 on Thursday open.
Yeah.
Then they never got back to me. Then a day later, someone said, hey, do you have time tomorrow open? I said, oh, I've got 2:30 open. They took 2:30. And then the first person emailed me back Thursday morning and said, okay, I'll be by at 2:30. I said, no, you already missed it. You didn't confirm quick enough.
Yeah.
So I've been looking for software that would allow me to have a booking page. And there are a number of pieces of software out there that typically allow this, but they typically have about $10 a month charges for you to use it. And they do a lot of things that I don't quite frankly need.
Yeah.
I don't need to collect payments. I don't need to have a whole bunch of different staff and a whole bunch of different options and all that. I just want something that integrates with my Exchange calendar And the product that Microsoft actually makes for this is called Microsoft Bookings. And it integrates as a part of Office 365. And up until fairly recently, it was only available for enterprise business level customers. So if your company was running their entire Exchange network off of Office 365.
Right.
Although, recently they opened it up to certain academic tiers. And there, it goes depending on your license with Office 365. But if you are on an academic tier that supports it, you can use it, but the caveat is you don't know exactly how to turn it on. There's no link in your list of apps that you have. There's no mention of it. And so I went onto a web forum, and someone basically said, yeah, I just went to this address, and we'll put it in the show notes,
yep.
And it let me set it up, and it let me use it, even though it doesn't say that I have it according to my list of available apps. And every time I need to reconfigure it, I have to go to that same URL. But thankfully, that URL is not too hard. You can take it and bookmark it. And so I set this up the other day, and it works just fine. As far as I know, it'll continue to work because it is technically a part of the license, but Microsoft just doesn't feel like making it easy to find for academic customers.
Right. So here's an idea. I don't know if you can do it. You probably have to go through your university's administration to pass this thing or to allow this thing to happen, but let's call it extra comfort appointments following the airline model. So this is how it works. So you can have these, a couple of set hours for coach level appointments with your professor, and they're free. You know, whatever you pay your tuition, that's part of your tuition price, and it's included. That so these are coach class meetings with your professor. But if you want an extra comfort seat, where let's say you can choose a better time of the day or a little bit more time, then you got to pay, say, $5, which is like the cost of a, you know, Starbucks a grande latte or something. And then for $10, we'll call this university class seats. You know, you can sit down during a meeting. Otherwise, you got to stand up.
So, yeah, you'll be given a nice chair.
Yeah. Anyway, just a thought. So that, let's say that'll cost $10, you know, so university class and then, comfort class, $5, and then part of your tuition is free. So there's some, revenue generation ideas for universities and the professors. I don't think John's going to do that, by the way.
It wouldn't surprise me if some universities went to it.
I found it amazing that Microsoft does not make this easy to find or learn about or...
Well, and as I've started searching, there are a lot of these little mini applications inside Office 365 that are just not easy to find. And I'm not sure if that's because it's designed to be your administrators can figure out what they... Obviously, your administrators get the choice of turning on and off any of these services.
Yeah.
But this is a pretty vital service for anyone who has people regularly making appointments to be able to throw it on your calendar and have it automatically block off. And then if the person cancels, you get a reminder and you can easily remove the appointment. And the other thing is you can require users to put in some information, answer a few questions, put in a phone number. And then Microsoft actually has an app on iOS and Android for bookings that you can then pull up your list of, I've got so-and-so there tomorrow. I've got to reschedule. What's their phone number? Oh, I can just tap on their name, tap on their phone number, call them up and say, oh, I need to reschedule. So it makes it a nice unified sort of experience. And it does have all the features for collecting different, amounts of payment, different types of services and different staff members that people could meet with. So it does do all of those things that the other services charge $10 a month for.
Yeah. Nice. So you could do comfort meetings and comfort class meetings and, premium class meetings. Okay, awesome. All righty. Well, that's our podcast for this week. Next week or next time, I don't know what John's schedule is, but next time will be podcast 250. I think I want to try to invite some of our friends over to help us commemorate number 250. Mm-hmm. We'll have to figure out who's available. My time's been a little wacky over the last couple of months, but... Anywho, thank you again, John, and this brings an end to 49. We will talk to you next time.